Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. The Founding Fathers are under attack. Who knew in 2009, when I wrote my first book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and a litany of the other Founding Fathers would be under assault today? Well, I did, and that's why I wrote that book. It's my first, it's still my bestseller. Going out and pick it up whenever books are sold online. The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. You'll really enjoy it. Is an Article 5 convention the way to solve the federal power problem in Washington, D.C.? We'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back to the program. Very glad to be here. Let's talk about an Article 5 convention. It's a big topic. It's something people have asked me about several times. I've mentioned it in other shows. But in this particular case, there is a specific part to this, in that there's a list of amendments that a mock Article 5 convention actually came up with last year in August of 2023. So when you have specificity, when you have states actually sitting down and saying, okay, well, this is what we think we would do if we had an Article 5 convention, it's pretty eye-opening as to what this might possibly look like. So let's explain what would happen in this process. Article 5 means Article 5 of the United States Constitution. And that's pretty clear that the states themselves can actually call a convention to amend the United States Constitution. What it doesn't say, but of course the states could ultimately do, they could pass an amendment that would abolish the entire federal government. It could abolish the executive. It could abolish the Supreme Court. It could do anything it wants. This clearly shows you that the states have all the power. And how does that happen? Well, the Congress, by a two-thirds majority, can propose amendments, but so can two-thirds of the states. You see, so if you had two-thirds, which is 33 or say 34 states, propose an amendment or a series of amendments, that would be just like Congress doing it. So again, it shows you that the Congress is really representatives of the states. If you want to find the federal character of the United States Constitution, you look to Article 5. If you want to figure out who created the Constitution, created the general government, you look to Article 5. If you want to figure out who has all the power and supremacy in the Constitution, look to Article 5. If you want to figure out who has sovereignty in this Constitution, look to Article 5. It's ignored. It's ignored because it doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't fit the narrative, well, the Congress has supremacy. Of course, the Congress is going to say they have supremacy. Of course, the federal government is going to say they have supremacy because these psychopaths want to get things done their way. And the states often serve as a block to that. Also in Article 5, it says a state cannot be deprived of its equal representation in the Senate, which means you can't get rid of the real federal character of the United States Constitution. In other words, states cannot be deprived of the representation in Congress, equal representation in Congress. You might actually be able to make a case that the 17th Amendment violates Article 5 because you have U.S. senators now elected by popular vote. The states don't elect these people anymore, and you can have outside money come in. You could have, I mean, this has happened. During the Obama administration, you had a special election in Massachusetts to elect a United States senator, and you had all kinds of foreign money, meaning outside of Massachusetts, going in to determine who would be the U.S. senator from Massachusetts. Well, that might be a state being deprived of its equal representation because the state didn't get to pick. Now, only the people of Massachusetts voted, theoretically. But regardless, you had outside money influencing that election. So was that really a state selecting its own senator? Or was it an influence from other areas? So this is a really big question. But regardless, we have a method, a process by which the states could abolish the entire federal system if they wanted, a process by which the states could limit the powers of the general government to virtually nothing, a process by which the states could control the general government moving forward. They could abolish anything they wanted. They could change the powers. They could do anything. This is how the Constitution was created, after all. So the process works like this. 2/3 of the states can submit amendments. It can be through a convention where the states do this. It could be through legislatures. It could be whatever. 2/3 of the states. And then 3/4 of the state legislatures or conventions could decide if those amendments are ratified. Now, here are the problems with an Article 5 convention. Or at least one argument against it, and then the real political problems today. So for years, people like Phyllis Schlafly and others, the John Birch Society, and other groups, conservative groups, have complained that an Article 5 convention would produce what they call a runaway convention. Meaning that you would show up at this convention, it would go off in what direction, who knows, and it would produce all kinds of crazy, catastrophic things, and it would be a disaster. Another argument, of course, is that the United States Congress and the government doesn't follow the Constitution now, so what would amendments do? What would amending the Constitution do? To that, you can say, well, they don't follow the Constitution in terms of the powers that they're given. They go beyond the powers, but the general structure is there. We do have an executive branch, legislative branch, judicial branch. They do the things, at least procedurally, that they're supposed to do in each one of these instances. So they do follow the Constitution. They don't follow when it comes to the powers of the general government, which is really all that an Article 5 convention would seek to do, would be to control the powers of the general government. That's it. So let's talk about the other part of it, the runaway convention. It would only be a runaway convention if 38 states agreed to the amendments that this convention proposed. And when you look at a political map, and this is the political reality of any of this, when you look at a political map, a current map of the United States in terms of who controls what legislature, Democrats control 17 state houses. And there are a couple that are split and one that's nonpartisan. So you're talking about 20 of 50 would be either Democrats split between Democrats and Republicans or a nonpartisan, which is Nebraska. They have a unicameral legislature still. So you've got 20 out of 50, which means there's no clear 3/4 majority for any party. There's not even a 2/3 majority to get a series of amendments passed. You'd need 34. Now, potentially, if you said, okay, well, you could get the two that are split to maybe go along with this. Maybe. So then you've got enough, right? You've got potentially 34 states that could do this. Maybe. Be more like 33. So see, you're right there at the, you're right there on the cusp of having enough to do it. But there's no clear pathway to get 38. None. If you just want to look at it as a partisan manner. And even if you got 38, say, Republican states to agree to something, would the Democrat states then cry foul and say this is not something we're going to do? Would you actually have a secession movement in the United States at that point? Maybe. But one of the interesting things about this, of course, is that potentially some of these Democratic states, I will say this positively, some of these Democratic states might really be interested in having a check on the federal government. We've seen during COVID, Governor Cuomo in New York was a hero of the left because he stood up to Donald Trump. We've seen states like California do things that the left loves because they stand up to the Republicans. We've seen states like Colorado and Washington stand up to the federal government on various issues, and, well, the left loves that. So perhaps there's a pathway forward when you start talking about a way for the states to simply ignore unconstitutional federal laws and what they consider to be unconstitutional. Maybe there's a way to do it. In essence, what we're looking at here is potentially a return of John C. Calhoun's concurrent majority. This would be beautiful because you would have a Congress that would be so powerless, the only thing it could do would be pass legislation that all the states essentially agree to, or at least the vast majority of states agree to. You'd have to have a supermajority to get anything done in Congress. So your spending bills would be light, your taxes would be light, your foreign policy would be non-aggressive, you would get a situation where the United States Central Authority would be subservient to the states, which is what it should be. Now, it has powers that it doesn't require the states to have. For example, it can tax. There's no dispute in that. The United States government can tax. What kind of taxes would be the question? The United States government has control over foreign policy. We already have mechanisms in the Constitution that would put the states in a more powerful position in that way, with the Senate and other things, treaties. But this Article 5 convention could really get to the heart of the problem in Washington, D.C., which is out of control powers by the general government, or at least abuse of powers by the general government in ways that the founders never designed. So let's look at some of these proposed amendments that came out. This is August of 2023. There were a series of amendments. This is from the Convention of States Foundation, August 4th, 2023. They met in Williamsburg, Virginia. And these are the official proposals of the simulated convention. And they have essentially three proposals coming out this with different types of proposals. Three different areas with different types of proposals. So the first is federal term limits and judicial jurisdiction. The second is fiscal restraints. And the third is federal legislative and executive jurisdiction. So you've got term limits and judicial jurisdiction, meaning the powers of the federal courts, which, by the way, Congress could take care of anyways if they wanted to. And then you have fiscal restraints. There's only one proposal for that. And then the last proposal would be federal legislative and executive jurisdiction. So basically restraints on those things. And they go after different parts of the Constitution where the Congress and the general government have been abusing powers. So let's look at these proposals and talk about them a little bit. So let's start with the federal term limits and judicial jurisdiction. Proposal 1, Section 1 of this proposed amendment. No person shall be elected to serve in the House of Representatives more than 9 full terms, this will be 18 years, nor elected or appointed to serve in the Senate more than 3 full terms, meaning 18 years. This article shall not disqualify any person from completing a term in the Congress to which that person was elected or appointed prior to ratification of this article. And Section 2, no person shall serve in Congress more than 24 years in total. So, you've got 18 years to be in the Senate or the House. Now, this is something that's been proposed quite a lot in the last 30 years. In fact, in 1994, you had the Republicans famously issue the Contract for America, where term limits were part of the big legislative push. We're going to get term limits. We're going to make sure that nobody serves more than whatever, 6 terms, 8 terms, whatever, 9 terms, whatever it is, whatever they're going to come up with. Term limits is a sticky situation because it could be unconstitutional for Congress to simply limit terms. This really has to come through an amendment because there's nothing in the Constitution that would prohibit a member of Congress from serving over and over and over again. And so they could make a constitutional case that if Congress passes a law, there's no power to do this. That would be regulating elections in a way that they don't have power to do. So you would need an amendment. Now, would this solve some of the problems in Washington, D.C.? you could make a case that having people with having people term limited would be good. You have turnover in Congress, which means you can't have somebody just sit there for, you know, 24, 30 years, whatever it is. Like Mitch McConnell, they get old and ingrained and they just kind of hang around. Nancy Pelosi, you've got all these 80-year-olds running the United States government right now. So maybe you get rid of some of these people. On the other hand, you might get rid of some good people too. And then you're throwing it back to the election. Now, you could say, well, this means that the Congress will always be more representative of the people themselves, because once a person gets into power, they get name recognition, they get all the perks of that. And that leads to a situation where it's very hard to remove those people. Incumbents are hard to get rid of. This is true. We've seen it over and over again. Incumbents are hard to get rid of. Maybe you see a situation where you have more candidates running for office. You might get a much wider political audience, so to speak. You've got more interest. I don't think it's going to get us any better candidates. I don't think it's going to get us any better people, because I think elections have proven that. Just because you have an election doesn't mean somebody's going to be better. In fact, I could say that some of the candidates have gotten worse. That's a reflection on culture more than anything else. Look at some of the youngest people in Congress. Some of these people are awful. Downright awful. So it doesn't mean you're going to get a young person because you have a special election or a seat is open again. But regardless, this doesn't mean, again, it doesn't mean you're going to get better people. It just means that you're going to have more elections. So I'm fine if we want to have term limits and term limit people out. On the other hand, I can see some problems with this. And I think this would probably be the most popular amendment that of all that are proposed here. Because I think overall in the United States, people look at Congress as corrupt and they want to get rid of some of the corruption. But it doesn't mean you're going to do that. It means that some of these people that are term limited out, they're just going to go serve as lobbyists. What you really have to do is get rid of the lobbyists. That would solve a lot of problems. And how you do that is rein in the powers of the central authority. If the money figures out there's no money in Washington, D.C., all of these people, doesn't matter how long they're there, all those people would lose their power. The problem is not length of time, it's power. And so some of the other amendments get into this. But as I said, this is probably the most popular, and it's the least effective in reigning in power in Washington, D.C. The least effective of the bunch. So popular, yes. Effective, no. Until you address the situation of extensive centralization and nationalism, you're never going to deal with this problem. So proposal two, also dealing with federal term limits and judicial jurisdiction. Section one. The Supreme Court of the United States shall consist of 9 judges, any 6 of whom shall constitute a quorum. Section 2. Each of the several states shall have standing to bring an action challenging the constitutionality of any action of the executive branch or any enactment of Congress. So, this is an interesting amendment. So, it's going to be mandated you have 9 judges on the Supreme Court, which means you can't enlarge it. There's no court packing. You can't shrink it. It's going to be 9. Now, why would that be the case? Are 9 better than 5? Are 9 better than 7? Are 9 better than 15? I don't know. I can make a case for enlarging the court and having it to be where it's sectional. You have judges from here and you do all kinds of things. I can make a case for that very easily. If the court's going to be the final arbiter of everything, which these amendments would say that it's not, but why 9? And 6, creating a quorum, you only have to have 6. So now you're getting 6 judges to decide for the rest of the United States? That's a little bit dicey. This is an amendment that's strange. Now, the second part of this, Section 2, is interesting. It gives states standing to sue on anything. So the federal courts can't knock it down and say, well, the state doesn't have standing to sue in this case. The state would have standing to sue on everything. But all that you're doing here is creating a more centralized nightmare. This is a bad amendment, I think. But I don't know if it would get ratified. I don't even know if it would pass 2/3 of the states. But I think of all the amendments, this is probably the worst. It's pretty bad. To me, the federal bench should be reined in. I mean, I think that the Congress should think about forcing judges to ride the circuit again. We shouldn't make these people so comfortable. That should happen. We could cut the powers of the subordinate courts in the federal court system. You could abolish some of those courts, some of the circuit courts and district courts. You could get rid of some of that stuff. You could make the states do what, I mean, the states would serve as the district courts again. That's really what should be happening. And the Supreme Court should only be there for major issues. And you could say that we need more than 9 judges. Or you could say, well, I need 7 or 5. I mean, we didn't always have 9. So why 9? Why this magic number of 9? We know that 9 isn't always very good. We know that 9 doesn't always create good decisions. So why 9? And why only saying 6? A quorum of 6? It's madness. 6 people get to decide now? Madness. This amendment is madness. Now, I do like the second part, the states can sue. But again, what you've done there is create centralization, which isn't what we should be looking for. And so we shouldn't want more centralization. We should want less. All right, fiscal restraints. This is the only proposal under the heading of fiscal restraints, and it has 5 sections. Section 1, Congress shall adopt a preliminary fiscal year budget no later than the first Monday in May for the following fiscal year and submit said budget to the President for consideration. Federal expenditures for each fiscal year shall not exceed average annual revenue collected in the prior 3 fiscal years. Total expenditures shall include all expenditures of the United States, including those for payment of interest on debt. Total revenue shall include all revenue of the United States except that derived from borrowing. Any surplus of revenue over expenditures in the fiscal year shall be applied to outstanding federal debt. So what this is doing is saying that you've got to have a balanced budget. It's a balanced budget amendment. Now, here is the issue with what they have just said. The language here is bad. Congress shall adopt a budget and send it to the president for consideration. What does that mean? Does that mean the president gets to be involved in the budgetary process? Because the way it works now is the president creates a budget and then Congress works off of that budget. The executive branch says, okay, these are the things we want to spend. That's how we want to spend money. And here, Congress, you debate it. So they flip the situation on its head. Congress should be in charge of the budget, not the president. And the president really shouldn't have any consideration in any of it. The Congress should just present a budget. Meaning, the Congress should pass a budget. The Congress should pass a legislative package of spending, controlling the purse strings, and taxing. That's what it does. Now, what it says here is that it's going to be based on the average annual revenue collected in the prior 3 fiscal years. There is an issue with this when you look at what's happening in the United States right now with the federal debt and, of course, spending. We're going to be getting to a point because of interest rates very soon where the entire federal budget is going to be taken up by servicing the debt. That's it. What this thing would essentially force the United States government to do is declare bankruptcy. It would happen. Within 3 years. It says Section 5 says they give you 3 years to put this into effect. So you're going to have a couple of issues. One, you might get the Federal Reserve then say, okay, then we're going to cut interest rates to basically zero again. So you're really going to heat up inflation. It's going to happen. That could be a potential problem. The other is that they don't do that. They keep interest rates where they're supposed to be. And of course, the federal government is bankrupt. So you're going to see massive spending cuts. You'd have to. I mean, to the point of where there may not be any money for several things. Now you could say, well, that's a great thing. Yeah, I mean, okay. Unless you rein in federal power, this is going to be an issue, and I don't think it's going to be very popular. And then, again, what happens with wars? When we have a war, this is always going to be the argument. Okay, well, what happens with wars? Or you could say we're going to raise taxes to a point to increase this is the other issue. You might see a huge tax increase. We're going to increase taxes to a point where we get, 75% because we got to come up with the revenue to pay for all this stuff. That's the other problem. I mean, you can either cut spending or raise taxes, and I think they would probably go the raising taxes route. A balanced budget amendment is problematic because of the way Congress is going to look at these things. The best thing is for the states to start knocking down federal control of these issues, and then this would be irrelevant again. The problem in Washington is not that we don't have a balanced budget. The problem is Washington spends money that they're not authorized to do. Washington exceeds the powers that has been delegated by the Constitution. That's the problem. Section 2, Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses of Congress by roll call vote deem it necessary, may exceed the spending limit in Section 1 for the fiscal year by borrowing as provided for the second clause of the 8th section of Article 1 of this Constitution. So there are, I mean, there is the issue of, well, they can go out and they can borrow, essentially for war. And Section 3, taxes levied under the 8th section of Article 1 of the Constitution shall not be raised to increase the revenue of the United States unless two-thirds of both houses of Congress by roll call vote concur. So they're trying to say, okay, well, we're not going to have the tax increase situation. You would get two-thirds vote all the time. I think you would get it. At least initially, because I think they would realize we're going to face a financial cliff if we do this. And it would be, you know, you would have to cut spending because of the current debt in a way that would be really difficult to pull off. I just don't see this amendment really going anywhere. Nothing in this amendment shall be construed to allow for an increase in taxes without the express approval of Congress. So it's trying to go after, all right, we're not going to raise taxes, we're going to cut spending, we're going to do it because we're going to have a balanced budget. We know states operate under a balanced budget. The problem, the dirty little secret, the devil's in the details with the states. They get huge chunks of cash from the general government to carry out a lot of the policies that they put into effect. So if they just had to rely on their own revenues, the state spending would be dramatically less. The states are slopping at the trough. So what would have to happen in all of this? People want federal spending, or they want government spending. They do. They just want it. So what you'd have to see is state taxes go up, federal taxes go down, which is the constitutionally correct way to handle it. But that's what you would see, because people want the government to spend money. I could see some real political pitfalls in all of this. I'm not saying that these things wouldn't be good, but you would have some adjustments, and they might be pretty difficult adjustments for a time. So this one, I think, would be popular maybe in some of the Republican-controlled states, but I'm not so certain you could even get 38 to agree to it, even with Republican-controlled states. I think that they would, well, what about our revenue? What about our... Again, the real issue is not revenue or taxes. It's not balancing the budget. It's reining in federal, unconstitutional federal power. That's the real issue. If the government didn't have the ability to spend, if there was a concurrent majority, and you would say, all right, we can only get these things, we can only spend money on these things, that's how you really affect it. Not a balanced budget. So that gets us to federal legislative and executive jurisdiction. Proposal 1. Section 1. Four sections in this one. Commerce among the states shall mean buying, selling, or transportation of commercial goods and services across state lines. So they've defined commerce, which is interesting because goods and services, what is that? So is an individual responsible for that, or is that just state action? Again, it doesn't get into that particular question because that's also an issue. Is it individual action? Is it state action? What does that mean? Section 2, but it does say that it's only that. It's only crossing state lines, so not the regulation of internal or intrastate commerce. Commerce is not intrastate, it's only interstate. Congress shall not delegate any rulemaking function related to commerce among the states to any executive official or agency. So Congress is the only one that can deal with this. You can't have some federal regulatory agency doing this, which again is knocking down some of those things, like the Interstate Commerce Commission. Section 3, any federal law or regulation existing at the time of ratification of this amendment and conflict with this amendment shall become null and void 2 years after the date of ratification of this amendment. So, I mean, the ICC, I mean, is OSHA then unconstitutional? This is really good. This would be a pretty substantial amendment. And I can see where this would be beneficial. What about the FDA? Is that unconstitutional? Because that's under the Commerce Clause. What about Obamacare? I mean, is that commerce? Commercial goods and services. Is that commerce? But of course, they're saying the buying, selling, or transportation. So you're selling, for example, health insurance plans. Does that fall under it? Transportation is railroads, cars. That's commerce. So it doesn't really restrict commerce. It does restrict it to just interstate things. And I still think the Commerce Clause is going to be abused under this. For purposes of this Constitution, navigable waters shall be limited to surface waters actively used for transportation of goods and commerce among the states. So it'd be rivers, right? But what about air transport? What about, again, automobile transport? Does that mean you can still use the Commerce Clause to build roads, like the interstate system? Does it mean that? I mean, so there's a lot of loopholes in here that I could see problems with if you're trying to rein in the federal spending and federal power. Again, the problem is federal spending and unconstitutional federal power in a way that this amendment probably wouldn't take care of. But maybe the next one would. This is the only one, I think, on the list that's worthy of really serious consideration. Because what it does is set up a way for the states to check the power of the central authority. This puts teeth in it. Section 1. The legislatures of the state shall have authority to abrogate any action of Congress, President, or administrative agencies of the United States, whether in the form of a statute, decree, order, regulation, rule, opinion, decision, or other form. This provision should not apply to presidential action taken pursuant to Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, and to presidential appointments. So, the legislatures of the states have the authority to abrogate any action of Congress, President, or administrative agency of the United States, whether in the form of a statute, decree, order, regulation, rule, opinion, decision, or other form. So the states have the power to veto an action of the federal government. Such abrogation shall be effective when a simple majority of the legislatures of the states declare the same provision or provisions of federal law to be abrogated. This abrogation authority may also be applied to provisions of federal law existing at the time this amendment is ratified. The state executive and judicial branches shall have no authority or involvement in this process. So this is just the legislatures. No governor, no courts. They can even get rid of stuff that's already on the books. So this would be to go out. The states could go out just 50% of the states. So you only need 26 states. And you could start undoing all of the unconstitutional federal legislation. Now, this is the one that would probably be least likely to get ratified. Because all of the blue states would essentially recoil in horror at this potential thing. Because, I mean, this could be a disaster for them. You've got enough red states that this would happen. So I doubt this one would actually get ratified. Because again, you need 38 states. I don't think you can find enough blue states that would do it. They just wouldn't. It's a pipe dream. No government entity or official may take action to enforce a provision of federal law after it's abrogated according to this amendment. Any action to enforce a provision of abrogated federal law shall be enjoined by a federal or state court of general jurisdiction in the state where the enforcement action occurs, and costs and attorney fees of such injunction shall be awarded against the entity or official attempting to enforce the abrogated provision. Qualified and sovereign immunity should not be applied or not be available as a defense in such an action. So, again, the states say, you know what, this law is null and void. A federal official says, we're going to enforce it anyways. You're immediately arrested, you're hauled before a court, and you got to pay all your court costs, and you can't declare sovereign immunity. Well, I'm a sovereign immunity of the federal government. First of all, that whole idea of federal sovereign immunity is absolutely ridiculous. That government has no sovereignty. They can't have sovereign immunity. The federal government cannot have sovereign immunity. The states can, according to the 11th Amendment, but not the federal government. Can't exist. It's not sovereign in anywhere. in any way. Clearly, Article 5 shows that. The federal government has no sovereignty. It has powers. It has supremacy on certain delegated authorities. But it has no sovereignty because those things can be revoked at any time. That's not sovereignty. It doesn't have sovereign immunity. Section 4, no provision abrogated pursuant to this amendment may be reenacted or reissued in its original or substantially similar form for 10 years from the date of the abrogation. So you've got 10 years. After they get rid of something, Congress can't do anything about it for 10 years. 10 years they can revisit it. And the states can just say, no, we're not going to do that. This is a very strong 10th Amendment proposal. It's an enforcement mechanism of the 10th Amendment. It's very strong. Probably the least likely to get ratified. If I looked at this list, the only one that I think would be ratified would probably be the first one, the term limits. And that would be it. And people would say, well, that's enough. None of the other stuff would probably be ratified. I don't think a balanced budget amendment would get ratified. I don't think something limiting the commerce power would get ratified because the left would say, well, that's how we've gotten so many things that we want. They wouldn't do this. No. Definitely not the last one. Maybe the first one. Herein lies the problem of Article 5 Convention. It's not going to save anything. What really needs to happen is the states just need to do what they've done before, which is ignore the federal government. And when that happens, they do what they want, and the federal government is shown to have no clothes. The emperor has no clothes. They can't do anything about it, is the real issue. Now, actions on individuals, the states can't really block that. I mean, this was brought up in the ratification process. Well, we got powers that will operate on individuals, and so we're going to have problems. Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the case. But the first one of this list is the only one. So I don't really see an Article 5 convention because of the current legislative makeup of the states really being that effective. What we really need is, again, it's a great think locally, act locally moment where we could have some real conversations about these things. You would get some really limp amendments, I think, if you had a real Article 5 convention. There wouldn't really be a whole lot of teeth in any of them. I'm not sure it would be that effective, but it wouldn't be bad. I mean, I've got a whole series of amendments to rein in the powers of the presidency in my 9 presidents who screwed up America. But again, I don't know where amendments would go. I think that would be more effective in targeting things. That last amendment would be fantastic. A real 10th Amendment, a real 10th Amendment that would work to put teeth into it, be great. I just don't see enough blue states, so to speak, Democrat-controlled states who will want to do this because it would be very difficult for them to see any pathway forward. Now, if you raise that simple majority of, say, what you could do is flip this on its head and say any act of Congress has to have a supermajority to pass. I mean, you could do something like that. So anyways, that's my thoughts on Article 5 Convention. I think that it just wouldn't have the desired effect that people would want overall, but it wouldn't be a bad way to think locally, act locally, and start this process of what the states can and cannot do. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.